Oh, Jesus, you say the darndest things. Amen. Jesus did not settle a dispute between brothers. Not only did he not settle it, he told the younger brother to shut up. He said that greed is not a good spiritual foundation. Life is not about possessions. The tradition was that the oldest son inherits everything, and other sons are on their own to make it in the world. And Jesus did not fight against that tradition. This parable is obviously to make a point, but it implies some things that I don't believe. First of all, this night your life is demanded of you. Demanded by whom? By God? My initial response to that is no. God chooses life and encourages us to choose life. Now, some people believe that God controls when you die. I believe that God knows when you will die the moment it becomes history. I do not believe that God takes people from life to death. Rather, that God takes people from death to life. So, granted that this death to life is a life that we're unfamiliar with. God wills life, and yet we die for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with God. People die from car accidents, poor health, contagious disease, war at someone else's hand, like in El Paso and in Ohio. All of those have nothing to do with God. And with that, when death happens, God takes that person from death to life. God wills life. And ultimately, God has his way in that we have life. One of the churches that I served, I had a 13-year-old boy in my confirmation class, and he was an only child. And I got a call that he had been hit by a semi. He was on his bicycle, and a semi hit him and killed him. And so I went to the house, and I heard the grandmother say to her daughter, "God picks his like we pick flowers. He takes the best." And I said to her, do you want your daughter to be mad at God? Because what choice does she have if that's what you think God does? Some of you know that about a year and a half ago, my 17-year-old grandson was killed in a car accident. And his mother is also a pastor. And she was driving in the car a few months later and having this big fight with God about her son's death. And she was crying and she kind of screamed out, "Why didn't you heal him?" And she heard an audible voice say, "I did," right after he died. How much more healed can we be than to be with God? I've said that many times in many situations. But God's not in a hurry to make that happen. God wills life. Another problem with the theology in this parable, in which God takes people from life to death, is the concept of free will. Now, I grew up a Presbyterian, and they have a tenet of predestination, that God controls everything, is predetermined what will happen. And I rebelled against that a little bit, I guess. Because if God controls your life and your death, you really don't have free will, do you? Which is it? God is in control, or you have free will. God may know that if I choose this path, these things will happen. And if I choose that path, these things will happen. But God cannot know before I choose it which path I will choose. I have a third objection to this parable. When Luke was being written, the followers of Jesus believed he would be back for them any day. And so there was no need to accumulate anything to secure your future, because Jesus was coming to take them to the kingdom. Well, 2,000 years later, maybe we need to plan for our future. So having heard my objections to this, what can this parable mean for us today? Luke is the only gospel that has the brothers' quarrel, and the only gospel that has this parable. So Luke was addressing three things in the early church: covetousness, greed, and generosity. So covetousness is when I want something you have. So I think all of us probably know families that have had disputes over inheritance. Ugly disputes in families over furniture or dishes or jewelry, etc. Well, like in this parable, how do you judge whose greed is greater? The brother who gets the whole inheritance and won't share it with his brother, or the brother who wants some of what he's not entitled to? When my mother was ill and near death, my sister said to my mother, "I would like the picture of you as a little girl that hangs over your headboard." And she said, "Well, that goes to Joe." And she said, and then my sister said, "Well, then, I'd like the desk that's in the living room." And she said, "Well, that goes to Joe." So I said to Mom, "How many years has Bev paid your bill, taken you to the doctor's appointments, gotten your groceries? I think she should have the first pick of what she wants to remember you by." So when Mom entered hospice and her apartment was being dispersed, she gave them to my sister Bev that picture of her that Bev initially wanted. There's nothing wrong with wanting something to help you remember someone. Now, Jesus said that covetousness is folly. The life's not about things. It puts things in the place of God and has a total disregard for the needs of others. Now, there's another phrase: where your treasure is, your heart is also. Obviously, we're going to secure our future. Actually, we need to secure our future so that we're not a burden on our family or on society. So how do we know when we've accumulated enough? Well, that's what financial advisors are for. The point that Jesus was making, though, is that covetousness blinds us to the needs of others. An important point. The second thing was greed. This morning I noticed on Facebook that Representative Ilhan Omar had posted, "We do not suffer in this country from scarcity. We suffer from greed." That's preoccupation with material things. And it exhibits a lack of trust in God. I have in mind a politician, a senator really, whose net worth has increased $2.4 million every year for 10 years. His salary is $193,000 a year. So how does he increase his net worth by $2.4 million every year? Lobbyist money, obviously. Greed is before us in big ways these days. My ex-wife has a preoccupation for material things. She lives her life believing that the next thing she buys is going to make her happy. Sure, for an hour or a day or a few days. But in my saying, but it doesn't have the ability to make you happy, was not helpful. Or saying, things don't have that kind of power, was not helpful. The lesson is that external things don't have the power to fix internal perceptions. Preoccupation with accumulating causes a lack of generosity to those in need. When I think about people who are staying in our shelter, or the people who have been in detention or are currently in detention, and I think about politicians who have no concern for the needs of their hunger, of their fear, of their tiredness, I keep coming back to greed. That greed keeps them from seeing those needs. Because you know those detention centers are privately owned. And people are making money off of those. When I was a child, we watched a TV show called The Millionaire. Did any of you see that? Yeah. And in that show, you'd see that a person or a family had some sort of problem. And then Michael Anthony would come and bring them a check for $1 million. And then the show would end with scenes of how the family is now happy. So as a child, I came to believe that if Michael Anthony would just come to our house, we would be a happy family. As an adult, I realized that money wouldn't have fixed my dad's alcoholism. But to this day, if I'm feeling like I need to escape, I will fantasize about winning the lottery. Now, I can't win the lottery because I don't buy a ticket. Because I think it's a tax on the poor. For people who have no way of getting out of their problems, they think that, well, here's a chance, and I'll take it. And so they spend money on a ticket that could have been spent better somewhere else, probably. So the third thing that we learn from this text, this parable, has to do with generosity. Generosity is liberation from covetousness and anxiety. See, in the act of generosity, we lose sight of what we were coveting. My partner Craig has a collection of Manhattan glass. And we have a Presbyterian minister friend who also has a collection of Manhattan glass. And they were over for dinner, and Craig served something delicious in a footed Manhattan glass bowl. And so this minister was coveting that. And so when she was installed into a new parish, Craig gave it to her as a gift, and she was blown away. She couldn't believe he would give it away, and she was shaming herself for coveting it. Generosity is not about parting with your abundance. Sometimes it requires sacrifice. It requires paying attention to the needs of others. The problem is that when we see the needs of others, we are overwhelmed with the belief that the need is so much greater than what we have to give that we can't make a difference. Our generosity can make a difference. The text today invites us to check three things: our coveting, our greed, and our generosity. Amen. I like to give people a chance to respond to what they heard. So if there's something that struck you that you liked, feel free to share that. If there's something that you didn't like or disagree with, feel free to say that. Who has something? Yeah.
So I was raised in a pretty fundamental church. And when we were in middle school and high school, we were taught we didn't need to make plans for our future, for our careers, because Jesus was going to come back. So that would just be wasted energy. Mm. And, you know, I went on to college, went on with my life, and thank God I had a career option. But when I was back east a few summers ago and sitting around with some of my high school graduate friends, and one of them was lamenting about Social Security. You know it won't be here for us when we need it. And one of my friends said, Jesus is coming back before that, so we won't need it.
Thank you. I saw another hand over here. Okay.
I just wanted to say I'm impressed and pleased that you're not afraid to say I disagree with that and explain it. And I just think, that's why I've always called this the Thinking Man's Church, because we can do that and discuss things in context and so forth. Thank you.
Thanks, Barb. Any other hands?
I'm Karen. I struggle with this time to time, knowing that compared to Bill Gates or somebody, I'm certainly not rich financially, as you say. On the other hand, compared to most of the people in the world, I am sitting pretty. And so the challenge to give not out of my abundance, but to really be generous, you know, in a culture that counts on security financially. I remember years ago, and I was in Ohio and still Presbyterian, I was able to join a group that went to Guatemala and Costa Rica. And sitting in, I can't remember the name of the city, but this little part of the city which didn't have running water, and the women in the town were fighting for sanitary water and such. And they lived in homes that had dirt floors and corrugated roofs. And the hostess brought out to us cookies and Coke. How did they afford that? So I think for us who are really in pretty privileged positions to struggle with this constantly is a spiritual mandate.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that, Karen.